Gary Steingart never has to worry about writer's block. He has content coming out of his pores. That's what he told one interviewer, and we believe him. He's written several novels and a memoir. His latest novel is called Lake Success. It's about a narcissistic, self-deluded hedge fund manager named Barry Cohn, who re-examines his life with a cross-country bus trip. Gary often makes very funny trailers for his books, and for the Lake Success trailer, he teamed up with Ben Stiller.
Hey, are you white?
Are you a male?
Did you play lacrosse at one of these 14 schools?
Then the exciting world of hedge funds might be right for you.
Hi, I'm Ben Stiller.
And I'm Gary Steingart. And together we're
Lake Success Capital! Woo!
Yeah, that was...
It's great.
Thank you. That was one of the most fun to make. The idea that I had was, you know, in 2 minutes, can I sort of distill the essence of Lake Success, or at least the hedge fund part of it? And so the idea is, and you can see this online, of course, is that basically we're saying that if you're white and you're male and you played lacrosse at one of 14 colleges, you can get a spot in a hedge fund, even if you keep losing money. And then one of the characters loses $500 million on llama futures, but that's not a problem for us because he's still a white male.
Yeah, it's very funny and very well done. So what inspired you to write your new novel, Lake Success?
I think it was basically this feeling that, I am kind of a chronicler of Manhattan, where I've lived for most of my life, and I realized all my friends were gone. Nobody could afford it anymore, so they're all in, places like Chicago or Berlin or L.A. or the Mid-Hudson Valley, where I spent half the year as well. And the only people left were people who worked in banks or the people who loved them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that was the, I thought, well, I got to write about what's in front of me, and what was in front of me were hedge fund managers and, you know, lowly investment bankers, but mostly hedge fund managers and private equity people. And so I decided to write about that since they were the only people left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Can you give us, now would be a good time for you to give us kind of a Cliff's Notes summary of Lake Success without, of course, revealing any spoilers, if that's possible.
Well, the Cliff Notes version is sort of a man who has all the money he could ever need, has a kind of nervous breakdown for several reasons. One, of course, is that his hedge fund is being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and is also failing in many ways. But the major reason is that he realizes his wife doesn't love him, and his idea of a perfect life that he wanted to lead with his family is disrupted when his first child is on the autistic spectrum and nonverbal. So he decides that in order to elude the SEC and also to get away from this failed marriage and family, in his view, he decides to run away on a Greyhound bus in search of his long-lost college girlfriend who now finds herself in El Paso, Texas. So it's a kind of, I think at one point the book describes it as a middle-aged version of On the Road.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of accurate. Because
yeah.
All the dreams and excitement have been replaced with a feeling of, oh my God, I really screwed up.
Yeah, a lot of regret. Yeah, looking back rather than looking ahead. Well, one of the themes you explore in the book is neurodiversity. As you mentioned, Barry's 3-year-old son, Shiva, has been diagnosed as autistic, and it's possible that Barry might be on the spectrum too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, why did you want to explore this theme?
So many people I know have kids who are on the spectrum, and when I look back at the children that were my friends when I came to America and couldn't speak the language, I was, you know, kind of, nobody wanted to play with me. I wore this giant coat made out of Soviet gerbil or whatnot, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
but the friends that I did have, when I look back at the way many of them behaved, I mean, there's, once you learn a lot about the spectrum, I realized that, you know, without being able to diagnose them, of course, but many of them had some of the sort of stereotype movements and way of talking and interacting that possibly were on the spectrum. So I've always had a great appreciation for people like that, and also, you know, I've been meeting Temple Grandin the last 2 years was one of the great highlights of
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, she's hilarious too, which is goes against what people think of autistic people as being, you know. unable to express certain emotions. Everything is there. It's a communication disorder. And Temple communicates in her own way, but she's smarter and more intellectual than most of the people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this stuff kind of combined to create for me a portrait of a character, a book that would sort of have neurodiversity in it. Now, also, many of the hedge fund guys I would meet would talk about their fellow competitors and say, well, Jim is on the spectrum or Bob is on the spectrum, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm unable to, diagnose anyone, obviously, but it was almost like one of the main things they wanted to say about each other was that they had better social skills than someone else, although in general, there were some very poor social skills on display. The other thing they would say about each other is, Biff's mom never loved them. They
mm-hmm.
diagnose bad behavior through using either the spectrum or a lack of love. And those two things, the spectrum and a lack of love, are possible ideas for how Barry got to be where he is.
Yeah, yeah.
Emotionally and otherwise.
Yeah. I'm still not sure I understand exactly what a hedge fund is. And I've tried to look it up online. Like, you did a good job of explaining it. But I'm wondering, can you give me kind of a brief, witty, suitably Steingartian definition of what a hedge fund is?
Sure. A hedge fund is a way to make a couple of people very wealthy. And those couple of people usually aren't investors. Sometimes they are, but usually the people that are really made wealthy through hedge funds are people who actually run them. The hedge fund uses a 2-in-20 model. So what that means is, if you give me $100 million, I get to keep 2% of that, or $2 million, no matter how well or how poorly my hedge fund performs every year. And I also get to make 20% of the profits that are on top of that. But theoretically, I can keep losing money year after year. And if you give me $100 million, I will take $2 million of that every year, or whatever 2% of the remaining amount is.
Wow.
So the main part, and hedge funds invest in everything. So in that funny video I made with Ben Stiller, the trailer for the book, one of our workers loses $500 million on llama futures. What are llama futures? I don't know. We made them up. But almost anything can be traded,
mm-hmm.
including, of course, the derivatives that sent the economy crashing in 2008. So essentially, I see hedge funds as a way to transfer money. And remember also that, capital gains, all these other taxes, they're offshore. There's ways to not pay taxes on this income.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Essentially, all this is a giant scheme to transfer money from poor people, from the middle class, into the pockets of a tiny 0.01% of the population. And, of course, the last couple of years have only enabled that to happen all the more.
Thank you. That really helps. That helps me understand it. Man, I should get into the hedge fund business.
I know. What are we doing?
What are we doing?
Writing books and doing radio.
Yeah. Writing books, you're doing well for yourself. I think so. You said in an interview that Lake Success is basically journalism masquerading as fiction most of the time. And it struck me that, in a sense, it's almost been an immersion journalism project for you, because mm-hmm. in addition to talking to all the hedge fund managers, you also took the very same cross-country bus trip that Barry does. So did you do a lot more research for this book than you did for your three previous novels?
I think the only book where I did an equal amount of journalistic type of work for a novel was Absurdistan, where I actually hung out in all of those post-Soviet republics which comprise Absurdistan. But yeah, this was, I haven't done this much research in a very long time. And yeah, taking the hound, as we call it, the dog across the country in the span of 4 months was exhausting. It was one of those sort of something you do on a dare. A lot of passengers did go huge distances, 20-hour trips, 24-hour
mm-hmm.
trips. But this was a trip that took place. So I did the same thing as Barry. I would get off the hound and spend time in the very cities in which Barry spends time, which is Baltimore, Richmond, Virginia, Atlanta, Jackson, Miss, El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez across the border in Mexico, and then Phoenix and San Diego.
The Greyhound bus trip storyline really resonated with me because it brought back memories of this Greyhound bus trip I took with my dad many years ago, but our bus trip wasn't nearly as exciting as Barry's. Instead of the one-eyed Mexican guy falling asleep on my father's shoulder, it was me falling asleep on his shoulder and saying, get off my shoulder. I'm trying to sleep and stuff. So how? Yeah, you mentioned where you went, the route or route, I could say. How did you decide which places to go? Why did you choose those particular cities?
Well, I thought of places that were interesting, and all these cities have interesting histories. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to take a route through the South.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, when you look at the way our country works, the South has an outsized influence, I think. It's almost like the Confederate War never, the Civil War never ended. It's almost like the Confederacy is ascendant in many ways, or at least in the ways that it gets to set the dialogue for this country. There was an incident on the Greyhound bus that was very interesting that is described in the book, but that also happened to me. And that was in, let's call the state, Louisiana, you know. And I was on the bus, and all of a sudden there was a gaggle of white supremacists showed up on a bus that was mostly people of color and started talking very loudly about crucifying Muslims and Jews to start with. And I belonged to one of those groups. Barry gets off the bus and buys a New Testament coloring book in Shreveport, Louisiana to hold up as proof of his Christianity. And I saw the same thing and thought of doing the same. But at one point we passed Grambling State University, a traditionally African-American college. And one of these white supremacists, while quoting Breitbart and other sources, said, well, they have their colleges, meaning African-Americans, and one day we'll have ours. What part of Dartmouth don't you understand?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
but the shock of that was that, I mean, of course people have always thought these horrible things. But in the first summer of Trump in 2016, people could get up on a bus that was mostly people of color and proclaim these things. And what we did was we looked away. We pretended we were asleep. We didn't challenge them even though we were in the majority. Mm-hmm. And I think this book is partly about that. It's partly about the ascendancy of this kind of new America. An America we can possibly roll back, but an America I think we're presently living in right now.
That's right, yeah. You yourself are an immigrant, so I'm curious if taking the cross-country bus trip and writing Lake Success has changed the way that you view the idea of the American dream?
Yeah. You know what was weird is, I mean, you know, I mentioned those white supremacists on the bus.
Yeah.
You could tell that they were in some measure on the way down. And that a lot of the other people on the bus were in some ways on the way up. They were trying to, you know, they were working hard. They were, they saw an opportunity that was offered them to advance in life. And many of the people were self-billing themselves as part of this forgotten America, right? Mm. Of course, all of this had a hugely racist undertone.
Yeah.
But the country itself is beautiful, you know, and this is what you miss when you are sequestered in any kind of bubble in any place in the world. And I think New York and London form some of the biggest bubbles ever known since the time of Rome, the Roman Empire, when Rome was its own sort of planet. But the beauty of the country, from the foothills to the mesas, is so striking and is seen through a Greyhound window, which is a pretty big window if you find the right place to sit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like the country becomes its own show. You know, the country just wants to flaunt itself to you and show off, and it's gorgeous. And, you know, the difficulty of that journey was that it was a very ugly summer, which gave way to a very ugly fall and winter and several years of it. But the ugliness of what was happening around me and sometimes inside the bus contrasted so wildly with the beauty of our country.
Yeah. Has writing Lake Success helped you to come to some sort of an insight into what's going on here in the United States at this moment?
We've somehow magically created a society that by 2018 does not work.
Yeah.
It's a money transfer society with money flowing upwards. Once the money leaves the pockets of the people, of course their lives are harder. Of course they struggle more. But the people who are the beneficiaries of that money, the people who get the capital gains, tax breaks, and all the other things, they're not happy either.
Yeah.
It's almost a feudal society, you know, with nobody really happy about it, because the idea of America, of course it didn't work for all people, but the idea of America is that we were all part of a community. There were differences in income, but, you know, a person who ran a company didn't make 8 million times more than the lowest worker in the company. All this stuff is new, and finance has exacerbated it, and tech has exacerbated it, to the point where nobody feels like there is an America that is something greater than the sum of just a couple of geographical areas, or the social class you belong to. And that is a disaster, and that is why I think outside powers, well, one power in particular, are so able to exploit us.
Yeah, very well said. Final question, Gary. What do you want people to take away from reading Lake Success?
I have to say, I never, you know, I don't usually do this sort of didactic thing where I'm like, the reader must learn X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in the end, it's a portrait of a family in crisis, a family falling apart, maybe trying to come back together. In the end, it's how we live. For me, what's interesting in fiction is the personal is set against the background of the social.
Yeah.
And so that's the greater society and the smaller characters. I mean, War and Peace, of course, is the best example of that, right? It's set during major historic, cataclysmic historic events. But you only get to know those events through the eyes and ears and of the characters that you love, of lovers and families, and that's what I wanted Lake Success to be. Not War and Peace, of course, but a portrait of a slice of American history as seen through the eyes of one family.
Gary Steingart is the author of the novel Lake Success. You can find out more about Gary at wpr.org/beta.
The best compliment I received since the film has been out is from a 12-year-old girl that got dragged to see it by her father. She came up to me after the screening and said, I thought that The Residents were just some dumb thing my dad was into, but now after watching this, it makes me want to go out and make art.
Don Hardy joins us to talk about his documentary, Theory of Obscurity, a film about The Residents.